Good evening, everybody. Thank you. Tonight, I'd like to continue along a path I've been taking. I found myself calling this retreat in my mind a bright harvest, dark skies retreat. And tonight, in fact, apparently there's a meteor shower. Yeah? And I think it's pretty clear out there, so you might go out and take a peek later. And I'd like to look together, meanwhile, at some aspects of this deep play work we're engaging in. We could call it unwinding in the service of freedom. And I'd like to come at it from several angles. The first one is one of the koans that we've appropriated from the West, a statement that is sometimes attributed to Paul Éluard, that says, there is another world and it's inside this one. I've been investigating this. And actually, Éluard did something that was being described as a kind of retournement, taking someone's statement and sort of stealing it and turning it, yeah. And so this one has had several rounds of this, and the. Éluard's rendition began, I guess, with somebody named Albert Béguin in a book, L'âme romantique et le rêve, so the romantic heart and the dream. And he was then quoted by Ignaz Vitalis Troxler, never heard of. And then later it sort of came along and so here is the longer version from Troxler. That's my translation, so forgive me if it's not perfect, but as best I could render it, it says, there is another world, but it is in this one. And to reach its full perfection, it must be seen and professed. One must seek her future state in the present, and this sky, not at all over the earth, but in oneself. And then another version attributed to sometimes Rilke, sometimes Éluard, is there is another world, and it is this one. And then a fellow named E.M. Cioran made a further step with this. There is no other world, not even this one. So I want to start there, actually. Found myself kind of loving that. So, because this sense of another world that is not really quite other is one that I think comes to us. You know, it's a way of expressing that dreamlike quality that we notice in life. There is another world, and what's that? You know, there is this world, and what's that? You know, and so in Buddhism, we sometimes then make reference to three bodies, yeah? The Trikaya, three bodies of Buddha, three bodies of us, three bodies of this. And I love how they map onto this trio, yeah? Because if we have, there is no other world, not even this one, we could say that's the view of the vastness, yeah? None of it, there is nothing divisible, there is no thing at all, right? And there is only the plenum, so indivisible that you can't say there is a single thing. And then you have, there is another world, and it is this one, which I think we could claim as the body, as the, you know, this is it, yeah? Just look, right here. And then we have, there's another world, but it's in this one, yeah? Find the sky in yourself, which we could say is that dreamy sambhogakaya, the bliss body, where, so don't worry about those terms, but I just, for those who are familiar with them, I wanted to bring that in a little bit. So this sense that this is something we feel, you know? Sometimes this feels utterly real and utterly necessary, yeah? This world. And yeah, sometimes it looks oddly fresh, oddly unlike itself, but we would still call it this world, yeah? And sometimes nothing to be found that is a separate thing, right? Sometimes we are resting in the vastness, and there's no need to call anything a thing. No need to have a name or a past or a future. And sometimes we're in that place where we're just noticing how dreamlike it all is. The dance, where is that sky? Where is that sound? How big is my breath? Yeah? So we feel it, we notice it, and sometimes we wrestle with it, sometimes we're troubled by it. You know, this off-balance feeling when we're sort of landing out of one of those states into another. And how do we investigate this? What is our actual experience of it? So, one description of the unease that sends us looking is that one from Thomas Merton that I read last night. Yeah? So I'll read that again. He says, every one of us is shadowed. Isn't that, that's such an interesting word. You know, that feeling of being shadowed by, yeah, is shadowed by an illusory person, a false self. I wind my experiences around myself and cover myself with glory like bandages in order to make myself perceptible to myself and to the world as if I were an invisible body that could only become visible when something visible covered its surface. I just love that as a description of this uneasiness of, well, what? I can't quite figure out what I am, so I'll just plaster it with old used billboards, you know? and call it good. So, but I also was struck in looking at this from a second angle by our dreams from this morning, the dreams that you brought in. So forgive me, I'm not going to probably be talking about your dream. I'm going to be talking about how it landed in my mind. So please forgive me. But I was really struck by an aspect that seemed to me to run through these dreams. So, and I think I would call it go deeper. So if you think about the dream of hurtling down a dark road, where the side's not visible, but all of a sudden here come the blaring lights of an oncoming train and you sideswipe the train. Okay, there's one. Then you have a couple, an older couple, a maybe gray-haired woman and a Japanese man, is that what you said? Something like that? Who are standing by the edge of the sea in wetsuits, getting ready to go in, which is going to be the beginning of the war. Right? Was that something like that? Okay. And then you have a young woman who is dead, maybe. An older, and she turns out to be a young blonde woman, and a darker hair, darker, older woman, desperately trying to resuscitate her, wailing at her failure, and then the young woman popping an eye open. And then we have two people, woman and a man, walking, and I wasn't too clear about this part, but visiting houses, walking along a row of houses, and then behind the row of houses, a great white-covered mountain behind. So what struck me here was the pay, and then the message coming from the teacher, go deeper, and then the response, I don't know how to go deeper, and then the instruction, go outside and act it out. Everybody outside and act it out. Okay. So, if you think about those dreams, they're all in pairs. Isn't that striking? You have going down the dark road, blaring lights of train coming the other way. You have a dark-haired man and a light-haired woman at the edge of the sea, plunging in, and this contrast between, we thought Pearl Harbor was the start of the war, but this is how the war is going to start. And then you've got alive or dead, you know, blonde and dark, dying or dead and resuscitating, but alive. So you've got pairs there. And then you've got that two people, the houses, and the mountain behind. Are these not in some way embodiments of our questions about duality? Yeah? The twos. And our way that says, not two, not two. What's the, it's as if the dreams were all asking, what's the not two of this? Yeah? And there's the go deeper, go deeper, go outside and enact it. I love it when people have me say things that seem right. Anyway, so they all seemed to me in some way to be about the call of seshin, which means to touch the heart mind, to touch that which is undivided. Yeah? To touch the wholeness of it. And so, how do we resolve the dogged dualities? Yeah? How, what do we do with those? And there's this sense that our habits are only skin deep, because in each of these dreams, there was a sense of somehow this duality not being completely real or something. Yeah? And so I've been thinking some more about this unwinding, this which seems to me to have also, can you feel a connection of unwinding with the undoing of dualities, the easing of the bind? Maybe we could call it the unbinding of the dualities. Yeah? And so so I found a couple of stories from two different angles. And one of them's a koan, and the other's a narrative. And so I want to bring these in for you. So first the koan. It's case 8 in the Muon Kan, the doorless gate or the gateless barrier, a book of many names. So Shi Chung made 100 carts. Some of you know this one well and some don't. So this guy made 100 carts. If you take off both wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? So Shi Chung made 100 carts. If you take off both wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? Can you feel a connection with this question? What if you take it apart? Yeah? What if you take off wheels and the axle? What would be vividly apparent? And the verse says, where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. Where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. The four cardinal half points above, below, north, south, east, west. Remind you of anything we read today, this afternoon, not too long ago? So let's hear what Linji says about us. Followers of the way, this lone brightness before my eyes now, this person plainly listening to me, this person is unimpeded at any point, but penetrates the 10 directions, free to do as you please in the threefold world. And then a little further down, he says, if you want to be free to be born or die, to go or stay as one would put on or take off a garment, then you must understand right now that the person here listening to this Dharma has no form, no characteristics, no root, no beginning, no place you abide, yet you are vibrantly alive. Alive, alive, alive. Okay. That is what he calls the secret of the matter. Okay, so taking apart the carts, kind of what Linji's doing for us, right? What would be vividly apparent? So maybe I'll just leave that there for a minute. See if I can slow down a little bit. I get all excited and go too fast. Okay, so my favorite current reading is Joshua Slocum, Sailing Alone Around the World, which is the source, by the way, of Billy Collins' wonderful poem, Sailing Alone Around the Room. So here's Joshua Slocum. He was born in 1844, and he was declared dead in 1909 because he never came home from his last voyage. And he was from Nova Scotia. And he had quite an amazing early history. You know, grew up around boats, and made boats, and sailed boats, and repaired boats, captained boats. As you can imagine, his personal life was maybe a little difficult. But in 1892, someone gave him an old boat. I don't know if it was already named the Spray or if he renamed it Spray, but here's the story. So one winter day in 1892, at Loose Ends on the Boston waterfront, Slocum met an old friend, a prosperous retired whaler named Captain Eben Pierce. "Come to Fairhaven and I'll give you a ship," the ex-whaler said to the ex-merchant captain. But he added, "She wants some repairs." So Slocum went down to Fairhaven and discovered how many repairs. But it took a while. He had other things to do. He said it was an ancient oysterman called Spray and was lying high and dry in a pasture along a river. Okay, so he talks about how he reshaped her. He handpicked the trees and the kind. He knew his woods so well from all of his work. He picked exactly the right wood for each piece of what he's going to do. And the story of that is gorgeous, but not for tonight. And finally, in 1895, at age 51, with $1.50 in his pocket, he sailed off in this 37-foot-long sailboat, decided he's going to sail around the world. And what was fascinating, one of the things that was fascinating to me in reading this story, which I still haven't finished, is how he was, it says, sailing alone around the world. He was alone some of the time, but like every 4 days, he would catch sight of, you know, a ship. And he would sort of go along in one direction, and a big storm would come, and it would pretty well wreck his boat. But he was very skilled and very fast. So like in one of the storms that boom completely broke in half, and he says, "Yeah, but I was quick enough to get it into the boat, you know." And then he would hobble, and he would manage to sail this wreck to the next available harbor, and then he would just hole up there for a while and rebuild, you know. And so it seemed like he spent as much time rebuilding his boat as he did sailing. And then he would make friends with the guys in the harbor, and when it was time for him to sail out, they would all be like sailing along with him and, you know, raising one more glass and saying, "Good luck," you know. So, but his description of being alone was, I thought, worth reading to you, because here you are sitting. During these, so he was in a fog. He was in a fog on the, and he had rigged this boat so that it would steer. She would steer herself, so he could sleep at night, which is very rare. I mean, how many people know how to do that? In 1895, so he's trying to get to the Gulf Stream. You got to look at the sun as it touched the sea, and then saw the full moon. He said, "Then I turned my face eastward, and there, apparently at the very end of the bowsprit, was the smiling full moon rising out of the sea. Neptune himself coming over the bows could not have startled me more. 'Good evening, sir,' I cried." I don't know about that "sir" part. "Um, Many a long talk since then I have had with the man in the moon. He had my confidence on the voyage. About midnight, the fog shut down again, denser than ever before. One could almost stand on it. It continued so for a number of days, the wind increasing to a gale. The waves rose high, but I had a good ship. Still, in the dismal fog, I felt myself drifting into loneliness, an insect on a straw in the midst of the elements. I lashed the helm, and my vessel held her course, and while she sailed, I slept. During these days, a feeling of awe crept over me. My memory worked with startling power. The ominous, the insignificant, the great, the small, the wonderful, the commonplace, all appeared before my mental vision in magical succession. Pages of my history were recalled, which had been so long forgotten that they seemed to belong to a previous existence. I heard all the voices of the past laughing, crying, telling what I had heard them tell in many corners of the earth. Does that remind anybody of something, of another story? That, you know, the telling of the night of the Buddha's awakening, that we have the Kalaso version in our sutra book, talks about how in that night he recalled first his life and then all of his past lives, and then suddenly they were not his anymore, but the lives of others. And so I thought that was fascinating. The loneliness of my state wore off when the gale was high and I found much work to do. When fine weather returned, then came the sense of solitude, which I could not shake off. I used my voice often, at first giving some order about the affairs of a ship, for I had been told that from disuse I should lose my speech. At the meridian altitude of the sun, I called aloud, "Eight bells!" Again, from my cabin, I cried to an imaginary man at the helm, "How does she head there?" And again, "Is she on her course?" But getting no reply, I was reminded more palpably of my condition. So, and then he decided to sing. He remembered that as a kid he had sung. He said, "You should have seen the porpoises leap when I pitched my voice for the waves and the sea and all that was in it. Old turtles with large eyes poked their heads up out of the sea as I sang Johnny Boker and Will Pay Darby Doyle for His Boots and the like." But the porpoises were, on the whole, vastly more appreciative than the turtles. They jumped a deal higher. And anyway, lots of stories like that. But then, he gets sick. So this is skipping ahead. He ate something he shouldn't have. I forget what it was. And he started to get cramps, and he got really, really sick. So he says he... and the storm's coming. Oh, plums. Or something else. Doubled up with cramps. Okay. And I'm a careful man at sea, but this night in the coming storm I swayed up my sails, which, reefed though they were still too much in such heavy weather, and I saw to it that the sheets were securely belayed. In a word, I should have laid to, but did not. I gave her the double-reefed mainsail and whole jib instead, and set her on her course. Then I went below and threw myself upon the cabin floor in great pain. How long I lay there I could not tell, for I became delirious. When I came to, as I thought, from my swoon, I realized that the sloop was plunging into a heavy sea, and looking out of the companionway, to my amazement, I saw a tall man at the helm. His rigid hand, grasping the spokes of the wheel, held them as in a vise. One may imagine my astonishment. His rig was that of a foreign sailor, and the large red cap he wore was cockbilled over his left ear, and all was set off with shaggy black whiskers. He would have been taken for a pirate in any part of the world. While I gazed upon his threatening aspect, I forgot the storm and wondered if he'd come to cut my throat. This he seemed to divine. "Señor," said he, doffing his cap, "I have come to do you no harm." And a smile, the faintest in the world, but still a smile, played on his face, which seemed not unkind when he spoke. "I have come to do you no harm. I have sailed free," he said, "but was never worse than a contrabandista. I am one of Columbus's crew," he continued. "I am the pilot of the Pinta, come to aid you. Lie quiet, Señor Captain," he added, "and I will guide your ship tonight. You have a calentura, but you will be all right tomorrow." I thought what a very devil he was to carry sail. Again, as if he read my mind, he exclaimed, "Yonder is the Pinta ahead. We must overtake her. Give her sail! Give her sail!" Biting off a large quid of black twist, he said, "You did wrong, Captain, to mix cheese with plums. White cheese is never safe unless you know whence it comes." "Avast there," I cried, "I have no mind for moralizing." So anyway, he passed out again, right? And but the guy is singing, "High are the waves, fierce, gleaming, high is the tempest roar. Hi, the seabird screaming. Hi, the Azor." So anyway, so Slocum complains, "I detest your jingle." "Your Azor should be a roost and would have been were it a respectable bird." So it goes on a little bit. But once he is over the fever, he wakes up and the deck is white as a shark's tooth from seas washing over it, swept of everything movable. But the spray was still going absolutely on course and going like a racehorse. Had made 90 miles in the night through the rough sea. And so he leaves it there. But he says that this the captain of the Pinta came back to help him a number of other times on his voyage. So you can see how this sense of dreamlike, you know, this is a sort of extreme, you know, example, but nonetheless, you know, there's that sense of in your aloneness, in your sailing alone around the room, you don't always know what's real. You don't know what helped you. Don't know what harmed you. You don't know what you did and what it means that you did it. You know, you don't know who thought your thoughts. Where did that thought come from? It's not that different. And I just couldn't resist reading you that part. The truth is. Anyway, but I wanted to then go to this other place where it's another bit of story. Can you handle one more bit of story? Okay. Because this is where we connect with the cart maker who made 100 carts. Okay. Besides that I've told you that he, you know, how much of his boat was the original boat by the time he got around the world, right? Because he kept remaking it and, you know, redesigning it and, you know, getting spare parts. But in this spot, he's sailing along, and he says that a current was experienced setting north, making it necessary to hug the shore, with which the spray became rather familiar. Here I confess a weakness. I hugged the shore entirely too close. In a word, at daybreak on the morning of December 11th, the spray ran hard and fast on the beach. This was annoying. But I soon found that the sloop was in no great danger. The false appearance of the sandhills under a bright moon had deceived me, and I lamented now that I had trusted to appearances at all. The sea, though moderately smooth, still carried a swell which broke with some force on the shore. I managed to launch my small dory from the deck and ran out a kedge anchor and warp. But it was too late to kedge the sloop off, for the tide was falling and she had already sewed a foot. Then I went about laying out the larger anchor, which was no easy matter for my only lifeboat, the frail dory. When the anchor and cable were in, it was swamped at once in the surf, the load being too great for her. Then I cut the cable and made two loads of it instead of one. The anchor, with 40 fathoms bent and already buoyed, I now took and succeeded in getting through the surf, but my dory was leaking fast, and by the time I had rowed far enough to drop the anchor, she was full to the gunwale and sinking. There was not a moment to spare, and I saw clearly that if I failed now, all might be lost. I sprang from the oars to my feet, and lifting the anchor above my head, threw it clear just as she was turning over. I grasped her gunwale and held on as she turned bottom up, for I suddenly remembered that I could not swim. Lots of sailors can't swim, actually.
Yeah.
Then I tried to right her, but with too much eagerness, for she rolled clean over and left me as before, clinging to her gunwale while my body was still in the water. Giving a moment to cool reflection, I found that, although the wind was blowing moderately toward the land, the current was carrying me to sea, and that something would have to be done. Three times I had been underwater in trying to right the dory, and I was just saying, "Now I lay me," when I was seized by a determination to try yet once more, so that no one of the prophets of evil I had left behind me could say, "I told you so." Whatever the danger may have been, much or little, I can truly say that the moment was the most serene of my life. After righting the dory for the fourth time, I finally succeeded by the utmost care in keeping her upright while I hauled myself into her, and with one of the oars, which I had recovered, paddled to the shore, somewhat the worse for wear and pretty full of salt water. And so he goes to sleep and wakes up with a young person trotting his horse around the sailor, around the boat, thinking it's going to be his. And then when he finds there's a man, the young guy Slocum thinks is probably ready to. The young man asked him what I was doing here ashore so early in the morning. "Your questions are easily answered," I replied. "My ship is from the moon. It has taken her a month to come, and she is here for a cargo of boys." But the intimation of this enterprise, had I not been on the alert, might have cost me dearly, for while I spoke, this child of the Campo coiled his lariat ready to throw, and instead of being himself carried to the moon, he was apparently thinking of towing me home by the neck. But Slocum was smart and told him that he was carrying a load of biscuits. And when he learned that, the kid took him back to the village to trade biscuits for milk. Okay, so the thing about this, to me, the thing about the whole adventure, but this particular little piece is how cavalier he is. And that he's, you know, the ship breaks, he fixes it and goes on. Getting around Tierra del Fuego, you know, took him a long time. He kept getting wrecked and having to try again and go a little bit farther and get blown back again. And So he's building and rebuilding the boat, and he's kind of building and rebuilding himself too. Could you feel that along the way? And it seems to be all in the game, in some sense. And I thought, this is our game too. You know, we build and rebuild our boat. We build and rebuild our sense of what's a practice, what will help us, what will take us on through our lives, what will further our adventure. You know, we build something and then it goes. It gets beaten into shreds, right? Is this not your experience of your life? And we build a sense of who we are. And then it takes almost dying before we'll give it up sometimes. You know, we don't give those up very easily, but they go. And we have one dream after another, yeah? We build and we let go. And there's something about letting that be a life that seems to me so important in this work that we're doing. So that rather than thinking we're on some straight line course where we're going to get better and better at it and finally we'll get really good at it and we'll get the paradigm that works and we'll get a clear vision of myself and everything will be ducky. It's a lot more like Slocum's Voyage, I think. Yeah? And can that be okay? Can it be the grand adventure, this life? Yeah? Can it be that, yeah, I'm going to make up a story and it's going to get trashed? And somehow making up the story is part of being a human being with hands that can help in the world. You know, we've chosen to be a body that can do some good in this world. And that comes with making the boats that have to wreck and making the stories of ourselves that have to turn out not to be true. Can we just let this be this particular beautiful life? So, in this retreat, we're at a time when there is so much sort of wreckage to be seen all around. And I don't say that lightly. Our hearts are heavy with it. It's hard. And we don't know what to do, and we don't know how to do it. And so we try one thing, and we try another thing. And sometimes we come to a place like this to stop for a little while. And I think that the huge gift of this time that we have together is that we can do a lot less constructing and a lot more allowing the unwinding as we're here, allowing the vastness to hold us, allowing ourselves not to believe the constructions, allowing them to get a little dim in the fog. Or just letting ourselves see the amazing points of light in the night sky. So maybe this is where, and we'll stop. And because I'd like to see everybody make sure that I've seen everybody today for work in the room, we won't have conversation tonight, but we'll probably be able to tomorrow night. Thank you for listening.